the thoughts for that exam. Okay? And it's a series of case studies, and each of the case studies has a variety of examples. And basically, it's all the examples that I can think of that we talked about for a particular exam. So let's say that we have a patient that has some sort of respiratory tract problem. Not saying whether it's upper or lower, just saying they have a respiratory tract problem. And then I give you a list of organisms that might be causing the problem. So the first question is, which of the organisms might be the patient's problem? And I would have like influenza virus and say, yeah, that could be it. Or I might say, Mycobacterium tuberculosis, and that might be, or Coccidioides inhibitus, that might be, and so on. The ones that we've seen before. And then I might throw in something like, HIV, or hepatitis B, or something like that, which clearly is not going to cause right then, because we're tracking, but would not cause that problem. So you sort through the list and see which ones are associated with the respiratory tract. Upper or lower or whatever, because we don't hold that much of patient information. Then I give you more information. I said, now we know back from the lab that the organism we isolated lacks mitochondria. So now look at the list that you picked, which ones still might be the patient's problem. So if it lacks the mitochondria, you'll remember that means it's a prokaryote. So anything that was on your list that was a eukaryote is now off the list. You know, it's the house game, and we put things up on the board. What might be the problem? And then we take things off the board. Well, the first approximation has to be as broad as possible, because if the answer is not part of your first approximation, then you go down the wrong path. Just like the fellow with the acute epiglottitis, and he thought that the patient had an allergic reaction, and got to go down, you know? Well, same thing. So we put up on the board that all things that are possible, and then they give you more information, and now you wheel it down until you come up with the answer. Okay. So now I say, well, let's see, the patient, we isolate from the sputum an acid-fast organism. So yes, you have to know whether it's gram-positive or gram-negative or acid-fast. You have to know what bacteria are and what fungal organisms are relative to their basic characteristics. So now we know that the organism on the list that could cause a respiratory tract infection, that lacks the mitochondria, that is acid fast, is going to be Mycobacterium tuberculosis. But that question is down. So for each patient, there'll be like five questions. And you start whittling it down until you get to the final answer. Once we get to the final answer, which is usually step three or so, then there'll be some questions about this patient. Now, if this patient was an otherwise healthy person, we thought, or if this patient had some obvious issues that might put them in the category of risk for HIV, and again, we don't have that done yet, we haven't done that lecture yet, but let me say that if somebody's an IV drug user, that might be a risk factor. You'd appreciate that, blood, from patient sharing needles and such. So that might be a risk factor for that. And if the person was maybe your age, 27 years old, you know, that's odd that they would get tuberculosis. So we put all those things together and deal with it. We need to do AIDS testing on this person. So which organisms on the list now might we be concerned about that we weren't initially concerned because we just had a respiratory tract problem? But now we know that it's tuberculosis, we say, oh, wait a second, maybe we should do some AIDS testing. So now you go back up on the list, and the question says, which one organism are you now, weren't before, but you are now possibly concerned with? You need to do testing. So now you come up with HIV. Now you know that if you have an immunodeficiency virus, even though we haven't gotten to it yet, you know it's going to depress the immune system, right? So the last question might be something like, now if we skin tested this person for tuberculosis, okay, the Mantoux test, as it's called. If we skin tested this person for tuberculosis, might they have a positive reaction? Might they have a negative reaction? Well, let's see. Depending upon the coincidence of these infections, they could have a positive reaction to tuberculosis because we know they have tuberculosis, and you'd expect that. But in the fact that we have a potential patient with AIDS and their immune system may be collapsing, maybe they don't have enough immune response to actually have a positive test. You probably do not agree. In fact, we actually have a name for that. You might want to write this down. It's called ANERGY. A-N-E-R-G-Y. ANERGY is the lack of a positive skin test in a patient known to be positive for the organism. And it's quite common to occur in immunocompromised patients. So here we have a patient that might have a positive Mantoux test, or they might have a negative Mantoux test. Okay. So that was one idea of a case study. So how do you prepare for something like that? Hold your breath, blow your nose, jump right in. Now, what you should do is you should know all the organisms that we talked about in terms of, is this bacteria, is it gram-positive or gram-negative or acid-fast? What do I know about this organism? And you basically, you're applying, with the exception of gram reactions, you're applying basic information about prokaryotes and eukaryotes. That little bit of basic information is going to be like a bit of a deal trick card sometimes when you're sort of bombing around and wondering how to deal with this organism. Well, what do I know about this organism? Well, let's see, I know it's a fungal organism, or I know it's a bacterial organism. Well, that helps me. Okay. I know it's a virus. That helps me. Okay. So those basic biology things you need to be able to use. And then you need to know the organisms associated with different parts of the body. Okay. Would an organism that we talk about that causes wound infections, is that going to also cause pneumonia? Probably not, not unless we told you the organism had that ability. So don't make any rash assumptions. Work on the facts that we give you. But there will be a case study for every one of these organ systems we talk about. So there will be one for the respiratory tract, probably one for upper and lower, but there will be at least the respiratory tract. There will be a GI tract one, there might be a dental one, there might be a sexually transmitted disease one, and so on down the line. When we talk about hepatitis, it's hepatitis A, B, C, D, E, plus other organisms that cause hepatitis, that could be one. Diarrheal disease, that could be one. Because when the patient comes in, they don't come in with a toe tag and say, oh, I got this. They come in with a collection of symptoms and signs, and we have to think of all the possibilities. And in real life, with this, two or more of the above is a possibility. Patients could have more than one thing at the same time. In fact, with certain kinds of situations like AIDS, it's almost a given that they're going to have more than one. If a patient that dies of AIDS doesn't die of the human immunodeficiency virus itself. They die of complications resulting from bacterial infections, fungal infections, viral infections that are both local and systemic. All of them are there. You pick one. On the death certificate, that's it. On the death certificate, all these organisms are present. So you pick them. It doesn't make any difference if the patient died. They have these unusual organisms in the bloodstream. They have brain infections with these organisms. None of this is going to be survivable in the long run. So, more than one buck is not even possible. It's likely in some settings. Okay. So, I know it's complicating. More than one of a buck is a frustrating kind of thing. But we're trying to move you into the area of reality, away from the area of test taking. And that's what this case study stuff is about. And case studies with multiple multiples are becoming increasingly commonly part of continuing education stuff. So it's not a big nuance that you'll never see again. It's something you'll be prepared for if you've seen it before. And there's a lot more sophisticated. You're getting your entry level kind of stuff. Okay. Later kinds of case studies, you can throw in false data. Believe it or not, the lab does not always give you the right data. They screw up sometimes, and you have to be able to look at that and say, oh, this other stuff? That doesn't make sense. This person is healthy, and they have a blood pressure of 40 over 12. That can't be. Okay? So you're going to go, that's not right. So we're not going to order blood pressure medication. This number just doesn't seem right. Okay. Does that mean you have to memorize numbers? No, but there's certain things you go, that's beyond the bounds. That doesn't fit with everything else. We isolate from a urine sample, hundreds and hundreds of billions of trillions of organisms per milliliter. Really? Is this person alive? I mean, this couldn't have come from a urine sample. Okay. It usually happens that They take the urine sample with a sit on the nursing desk for 12 hours. They rush it stat to the micro lab and come up with these answers. Okay? So you have to use, sometimes they do testing, and the patient is on an antibiotic already, and then they test the organism to see, well, that's not going to be very good. Antimicrobial susceptibility testing, the patient already taking antibiotics, leaves the antibiotics in the sample and still from the patient. That's going to screw the results up. So there's a lot of things that you have to look at and go, that just doesn't make sense. Check that data. So that's the next level. I won't give you that. But that's the next level up, which we'll see later on. So case studies are a problem set, just like doing algebra 1, and you just do y equals mx plus b kind of questions, right? Or you could have a problem that you have to solve. Well, that's what we're going to be doing. More of those problem solving things. The next test after that is the easiest test we give. It's the basic information about immunology. It's a new subject area for you. So the brain has to switch in a different way. But it's because it's new, we have to start off with a base level. It's sort of easy stuff. Not given easy, but it's masterable. The final exam is all case study again. So in that case study, it will be immunology case study and med micro case study. So what you're doing now is preparing really for the final. So it's not lost time. But it is a different kind of thing. So you need to think about, we've already finished the respiratory tract. Start working on those organisms, being familiar with the names, knowing which ones are fungal organisms, and so on and so on. Okay? Because you're going to need to know that as you refine that on the answer. I gave you an obvious one, but acid fast and only had one. All kinds of possibilities. Okay, we have primary atypical pneumonia patients. We have all kinds of things. So, find the answer to come. Okay. Talking about the GI tract, and we mentioned already the fact that we have 100 different plus species of Salmonella, what we call salmonellosis. Most of these are simply limited to the intestinal tract, causing a gastroenteritis. And this gastroenteritis sort of makes you feel, as the French said, mal général, a little queasy, nauseous, but maybe not throwing up too much. Maybe a loose stool or so, but not really frank diarrhea. Right? And then we progress from that. In some patients who are immunocompromised, particularly, they develop a gram-negative septicemia. Note that does involve an endotoxin. An endotoxin shock is a possibility, which will be fatal possibly for these patients, but it's still considered an infection. Okay? We talked about the term intoxication. In this setting, we're talking about only exotoxins. And then the third possibility is one organism out of 100 that can cause typhoid fever, Salmonella typhi. And that does have a toxin, but this is essentially an infection. But there is a toxin associated with it. We then talked about E. coli. And we said it was, of course, another gram-negative organism. That all of the first four listed there are gram-negative. It's a gram-negative organism. It's a rod. In fact, all of the first four are rods. In fact, we've mentioned that if we would do a biological genetic analysis of those four organisms, the differences are at the level of the subspecies level in many cases. But we have in general listed simply because in 1880, when we made these identifications, we didn't have that ability to do the analysis, and it's not worth all the effort to change all that information now. So they're very similar. They just have different factors associated with it. E. coli, we said we have the normal flora E. coli that in the intestinal tract causes no problem. Outside the intestinal tract can cause a variety of things. It can cause urinary tract infections, it has flagella and pili. It has a capsule, so under unusual but possible situations, it can cause a meningitis and so on, like a spinal bifida patient or something like that. Open spine. So you can imagine a young child with a diaper and open spine. This is a contamination issue. So that's the normal flora. However, there is a group of E. coli that have additional variances, which are in terms of toxins, exotoxins, that cause problems in the intestinal tract. We call those the enteropathic varieties of E. coli. Enteropathic. and there were two types of enteropathic varieties. ETEC and EHEC. The E initial first one, first E there is enteropathic, and the last EC is E. coli. So we have two kinds of enteropathic E. coli. Enteropathic toxogenic E. coli is the E. coli that we associate with swimming pool diarrhea, summertime diarrhea, you remember this deal, right? Infantile diarrhea, Montezuma's Revenge, Tijuana Two-Step, etc. But we call all of that traveler's diarrhea. Okay? So that's the clinical term that we put that whole umbrella. So even though it's called traveler's diarrhea, yes, young children get it at home and in the swimming pool and so on. But it's generally called traveler's diarrhea. And it's called traveler's diarrhea because of an unusual characteristic of the kind of antibody that protects the mucosal surface, such as the lining of the gut. And that was secretory immunoglobulin A, that's capital I, little g, capital A, IgA, capital I, little g, capital A, secretory IgA, which sort of has a problem with its memory system. So it's sort of the perpetual virgin antibody, each time is the first time. Okay? And there's a delay of about 7 to 10 days before you get optimal levels of protection. It's a traveler's diarrhea because the people who are in situ, the people who are there in Cozumel or wherever you are, they're constantly exposed to low levels of the organism. Last week's exposure stimulates this week's protection. The traveler, coming from Big Rapids, going to Cozumel, on the other hand, was not exposed the week before they came to Mexico. And as a result, they don't have last week's stimulation to produce this week's protection, so this week they get sick. And it takes about 2 to 3 days of exposure, and then you'll have a lot of rumbling in the gut, a lot of gas formation. That's one of the symptoms you're going to see. Abdominal distension, some pain. You won't get vomiting typically, but you will get a loose stool to the point of having diarrhea. It took you 2 or 3 days to get it. You'll have it for 2, 3, 4 days. That's our 7 days or so. And now the antibodies that you were stimulated when you first came are starting to come into protection. So now you start recovering. So if you had stayed 2 weeks there, the latter portion of the first week or so, that's when you get sick. Now sick in terms of diarrhea and stuff. You don't want to leave the room. You want to stay close to the bathroom and so on. But after that, you'll be fine. Okay. And again, almost humorously, but effectively, it would work if you brought the people back to Cozumel, the Big Rapids, and they drank uncontaminated water, and then you sent them back home, they would then get sick just like you did. Turn it off to their plate. That's why the traveler best bet is brought into the clinical description. Certain that would be the same biological mechanism that's going on. You get this in the Big Rapids in the swimming pool or whatever. Now, the people at risk for this are generally the extremes of age, 3 months to 5 years of age being the critical group. The last antibody that reaches mature levels is secretory IgA, the one that protects the gut. That is why there are hundreds of millions of GI tract infections around the world, particularly in malnourished developing world countries. And the lack of nutrition impedes protein synthesis, antibodies being proteins, it impedes your immune response. So a malnourished person is at risk. You put the malnourished person and you make them 3 months to 5 years of age and you expose them to contaminated water, they're going to get diarrhea. And there are many diarrheal diseases. We're just starting on a whole series of them, so there's many that could be in the case. And contaminated water is a common mechanism. Poor sanitation. You're drinking the water from the stream, and someone upstream just dumped their water they waded into, and somebody else swam in, and somebody else put their laundry in, and now you're drinking it. You wouldn't think of doing that. Someone comes out of the bathroom with contaminated water, gives you something to drink for that. But millions of people worldwide, that's their water source. So that's the problem. What we wash our cars with, what we don't think twice about, our chlorinated water, is the difference between life and death for many people around the world, particularly 3 months to 5 years of age. So that's the ETEC. We have the extremes of age being the ones at risk, whose immune system isn't quite right. Now we have EHEC. This is the enteropathic hemorrhagic E. coli. EHEC. This one is associated with eating contaminated hamburger. This one has its target population, might be in the United States easily. Typically someone in the middle ages. It's possible to have younger children, but usually we have early teens to late teens. Our typical patient is going to be probably between 11 and 19 or so. So the middle ages there. And usually it has to do with consumption. How much did you eat? With a lot of these organisms, you have a secretory antibody that you have some level of protection for, and if you can knock it out because you've got exposure to a small amount of organism, you don't get disease. So, but if you eat a large amount of the organism, then you get disease. Now, this hemorrhagic variety of organism spreads through the bloodstream from the gut and can cause destructions of the kidney and kidney failure, hence the hemorrhagic aspect. This will result in not only a hospital stay, but a stay in intensive care, and can be fatal. If it's caught early enough, it's usually just a stay in an intensive care and being pulled and back, because they're otherwise healthy people we're dealing with. Okay. These are not the extremes of age people. So they've got an underlying base of immunity, we just have to pull them through the critical stage. The effects of these toxins, particularly on the kidney. Now, where does this organism come from? Why do I say hamburger? Didn't say steak. And the answer to that is this variety of E. coli is associated with H70157. That's the seventh variety of flagella. And the 157th variety of the O antigen side chain, a very narrow kind of organism. That serotype is the one that causes the problem. Now, that serotype itself, that is the O antigen side chain in that particular serotype of flagella, is not the toxin. That's not the exotoxin. It is genetically linked to the production of the exotoxin. So organisms that have that are associated with the production of the toxin. Because we have the surface of the organism involved, as it turns out, we also have a common set of common villi. And that allows the organism to attach to the gut of the cow. And as we have increasingly more homogeneous cows, then we have more and more cows who that particular serotype and its villi will attach to. So when we have cows that are randomly bred and so on, we don't see the problem as much. But when we have artificial insemination, we have one bull and 5,000 cattle, then we have a problem potentially, because we're narrowing down the genetic variety of cattle whose gut receptor sites match with the common villi of H70157. We can track this organism from the patient to the hamburger, to the store, to the slaughterhouse, to the farm. Okay. Now, just because the cow has it in their intestinal tract doesn't mean that we're going to get into the meat unless we're not careful. So if you slaughter the cow at home, and you're very careful about the intestinal contents, hence of the cow. This is not in the meat, not in the muscle, it's in the intestinal tract. So if you carefully remove the GI tract of the animal, if you do your dissections prior to butchering and so on, then you don't have a problem. But that's not what we do traditionally in a commercial abattoir, slaughterhouse. In a slaughterhouse, it's all done automatically. I mean, you have the cow killed, and then it's quickly put up, hanging upside down, chained, hooked to a conveyor belt. Somebody takes the blowtorch and singes the outside of the hide and liquefies the fat underneath it. They then take off the hide, sell the hide for leather purposes. Then they dip the cow in the more solutions and pull it up again. It's all pretty wet. They then take a chainsaw and they cut it down the middle. They cut it down the back and split it in halves. And so it goes down the way. It's done with a chainsaw. This is not exactly the surgical procedure here. And as a result, the intestinal contacts, when they do come out, they sort of splash down in all the place. And now it's dripping on the inside of the hide or inside of the pores at that point. They go into more rinsing things, so now they've got the contaminated rinse water. So even if you did it right for 5 cows in a row and did it wrong for one, they're all dipped into the same stuff. So the organism is coated with the intestinal contents of your, the meat is coated with the intestinal contents of the organism. Now, if you take that meat and you slice it up and you make steaks out of it, and someone brings it home in a plastic bag and a little tray and yellow tray and all that, and you take it out and you put it on the grill, the surface may have been contaminated, but the meat isn't, so therefore you cook it and it's not a problem. A hamburger, on the other hand, not so much. You grind the hamburger up, so now we have surface on the inside. And if you don't cook it all the way through, then you have living organism on the inside. That's why you hear the summertime discussions about cooking it till the blood stops running, cook it till it's all the way cooked through, if you have an establishment of the temperature that you're looking for, and so on. That's to get rid of this organism. Because we assume it's there. Does it have to be there? No. Should it be there? No. Is it there? Yes. So we have to deal with the reality. So we assume that the meat that you bring in the house, just like the chicken that you brought in the house, is contaminated, and most often, or at least a significant amount of time, it is. 25-30% of the time, it is contaminated. That's pretty common. So obviously, one should not eat raw eggs and raw hamburgers. People do. Going back to that 15-year-old in that age range, they were at the picnic and they had 8 hamburgers. Period of time when teenagers eat vast quantities of food. And after they ate hamburgers, went home to the picnic and probably had 2 bowls of cereal before they went to sleep. Vast quantities of food at that point in time. So basically, it's the larger consumption. Everybody at the picnic may have been exposed, but they had a hamburger or two, and that load of bacteria was not sufficient to cause a significant problem then. But if you have somebody who had a whole lunch, or, of course, if you have somebody who thinks you're a weight builder, bodybuilder kind of thing, and they're putting on weight, and they're a teenager, and they're going to gain 20 pounds, and they eat raw eggs and raw hamburgers. True. How many people have heard people eat raw eggs and raw hamburgers? Now we want to do it? No. So, E. coli. Normal flora organisms, one set of problems. The enteropathic variety of different problems. Shigella. Shigella species cause a step up now in the GI tract attack. We now can have an organism that can invade the lining of the intestinal tract. Before we talk about organisms in the gut, maybe getting into the bloodstream and going on in the case of HEC, but now we have an organism that's invading the intestinal tract and attacking the lining of the gut. Various kinds of species are more or less well adapted to this. This being another gram-negative rod organism, this is sometimes called bacillary dysentery. Bacillary meaning bacillus organism. Dysentery is this more aggressive kind. kind of diarrhea. So we have the invasion of the gut. We might even have some sloughing off of layers of the gut. There's another variety of agent that also causes an attack on the lining and sloughing off of the lining of the gut. And it also causes something we call dysentery, but it's not a bacteria. So we need some terminology to separate these two kinds of clinical problems, similar name, we call it dysentery, but this one is caused by an amoeba, a parasitic organism, one of the few parasites we'll talk about. Parasitic organism here is Entamoeba histolytica. Entamoeba histolytica, and as the name suggests, it's an amoeba. So we call this amoeboid dysentery. So we have bacillary dysentery with a bacillus-shaped gram-negative bacteria, and we have amoeboid dysentery with Entamoeba histolytica, an amoeba-shaped protozoa. So dysentery is much more severe. It lasts for a longer period of time. It's eroding away the intestinal tract lining, which is where our secretory antibody is at. So we don't have that level of protection that we had before. Untreated dysentery, something that can last for weeks, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, or longer. A significant contributing factor is the nutritional status of the patient. How well are they eating? How well are they drinking? Are they well hydrated? Are they well nourished? If they are not, then they are at risk for a longer-term effect of dysentery. If you were to go on a visit or a mission or whatever to like Cambodia or someplace in Africa, it was dysentery about, and you came down with a touch of dysentery, it's a problem that might last 10 days or 2 weeks. Meanwhile, people around you are having dysentery for long periods of time. And these, again, are particular risk, in addition to those who are well-nourished and well-hydrated, are the extremes of age. So again, we've got this children between 3 months and 5 years of age. They are getting hammered by these diarrheal diseases. And they are dying worldwide in the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands or more. So we have a lot each year. So we have a lot of problems with these things. And because there's no immunological memory, we cannot develop an effective vaccine. Remember the people with the E. coli and the traveler's diarrhea and the people lived in Cozumel, they were constantly exposed. So we don't have a time-release exposure in the gut system. Okay? So that means that we have difficulty in developing an immune-based prophylaxis, a vaccine, that would help us against a GI tract invasion. We do have lots of different kinds of vaccines associated with a systemic immunity because there is memory there. So all a vaccine hinges on whether there's a memory or not. And so we don't have a good way of stimulating memory responses in the gut. So that's dysentery. Again, it's more severe, and we have different kinds. And of course, if you have a protozoa causing the problem, the treatment is different than if it's a bacterial agent causing the problem. Completely different kind of biology. Vibrio cholera. We're now stepping up. That all of those were infections. All of the Salmonella were infections. All the Shigella are infections. And the enteropathic E. coli are essential intoxications. And we talked about toxins. Essential intoxications for the ETEC and EHEC. Cholera is another essential intoxication. This is really an ingenious toxin system. The organism gets in the intestinal tract, and it's in contaminated water, as you expect with cholera, and we have now the organism releasing a toxin that has a very specific target. This target is a small bowel mucosal cell, In the small bowel mucosal cell, it triggers adenyl cyclase activity. Adenyl cyclase is going to take ATP and convert it into cyclic AMP. You probably remember from biochemistry, cyclic AMP and other cyclic nucleotides is often a messenger system in the cell, and that's exactly what happens here. As the levels of cyclic AMP levels rise inside the small bowel mucosal cell, under the influence of the toxins affecting the cyclic adenyl cyclase, the small bowel mucosal cell reverses its normal activity. What is its normal activity? Its normal activity is to pick up fluid and electrolytes. Water, potassium, sodium, that kind of stuff. It's got a very specific task. And it's an important task to keep you well hydrated. However, in this situation, it's now being directed to do just the opposite. That means it actively pumps out water and electrolytes. Your body is actively pumping out water, potassium, and sodium. This can be a good thing. The chronicity of this, because it can last for a while, and it can last for a week or so, and in the process, we actually can get what's called prolapse. That's where the lining of the intestinal tract is affected in such a manner that it is exiting the anal opening. It's folding out. Your guts are coming out the anal opening. That can't be a good thing either. Okay. You're losing so much fluid that the lining, like the sleeve of a shirt, is coming out during a loading, just folding right out, called prolapse. You lose so much fluid that you're too weak to go anywhere. And we have what's called a cholera cot. Nothing more than a stretcher with a hole in it. Your butt's in the hole. The bucket's under your butt. Just coming right out. Now it doesn't look like fecal material. It doesn't smell like fecal. I mean, there's no organisms there anymore. You've washed everything out. And so all that's coming out, well, the textbooks often call it rice water stool. It looks like the water you're cooking with rice. But we don't cook as much rice as we do pasta. So you can think of it as being the pasta water. So you're draining the water in pasta, you're making spaghetti or something. And you're draining it in the colander. Look back into that pot. You've done it. It's a starchy, gray, blue-gray color. It's a little bit of viscosity to it. That's exactly what this fecal material looks like. Okay. It has no particular odor to it. It doesn't smell bad in terms of what you'd expect the fecal material to smell like. It's just dripped right out of the patient. So they're losing everything. They can lose between 10 to 20 liters a day. Now, 10 to 20 liters a day is sort of an abstract number. This is probably 10 plus liters right here. Okay. So you lose maybe two of these a day. But a liter is about a quart. And a quart is 2 pints, and a pint weighs 1 pound. So now if you put that into pounds, 10 to 20 liters becomes 20 to 40 pounds a day. Now we have something we can put our hands on, our ideas around. That's a lot. How many days can you lose 20 to 40 pounds? Not too many. Okay. So this is not a disease that's going to last for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. If you got it, you're going to die from it. How do we treat this? What do we give you antibiotics? Well, antibiotics are not going to be solving your immediate problem. The immediate problem is you don't have enough fluid electrolytes. Now, traditionally in the United States, we would, at least historically, we would try to give you an IV if you had this. Of course, we don't see this commonly in the United States, but we would try to do an IV. And when we took that technology to Africa and so on and began trying to put IVs into people, that became a practical problem because now we're in the middle of Africa someplace. We have a young child, 4 months old, trying to start an IV whose body fluids are gone and you can't even find a vein. Okay? And a very young child should try to do it through the head, soft spot. This is not easily done. So because we have this severe dehydration, starting an IV is not easy. So in our position, working for a non-governmental organization, NGO, something like Concern or something like that, these non-governmental organizations are not, obviously not associated with any government, they're just there as a charitable group. And this fellow was trying to solve the problem, and the children were dying all around him. And what was he going to do? He tried to put water in them, and water is not picked up very well. You try to drink, it doesn't get up very well. But he found out they put water with glucose and electrolytes, that the glucose expedites the uptake of the water and electrolytes. And he discovered what we now call this oral rehydration. It costs about 25 cents to make a liter. A child is ready to die, and die within the next hour or so, will be saved by simply a liter. It looks like they're wilting, and then they start to come back to life. Their eyes are sunken in their head, they're just about gone, and they get them to drink a liter of water. Of course, that's only a child, so his volume isn't as much. The volume of a liter is more significant to a child. But he'll save their life. An amazing thing. So now we have oral rehydration. Of course, he had little packets of water, excuse me, little packets of sugars and salt, right? And he had little packets, and you get boiled water someplace. Obviously, you can't use contaminated water, which is not easily gotten in water. And then you put it in there, boom, save it. Now, it costs 25 cents for a little packet, for a liter. We buy it now at Pedialyte, which costs anywhere, who works in the store? Probably sell it for something between $5 and $8. Cost 25 cents. So I think there's a margin of profit in there, I don't know. I think you could probably make a living on profit. So a little bit of a markup there. So that's what we use. Now we don't have a major problem. That is, we don't have a population that's not well hydrated and not well nourished. Our problem is overeating as a society, not malnourished. So generally we're a well hydrated, well nourished population. Overnourished in some cases. We're the only country in the world that has diet dog food. Cycles, diet dog food. Unless we travel about, what we do for everyday living is obscene in some sense of the word obscene. Okay. Totally, we're missing the point in terms of what the rest of the world is doing. So, at any rate, so cholera, major problem. If you would go to one of these countries and you would come down with cholera, first off, you're well hydrated, well nourished, you would have a problem that would probably last someplace around 3 days or so, and you would get over it. You would not get down to the severe stage. And again, because the problem is essentially intoxication, the treatment is to neutralize the effect of that toxin. So we're going to use that oral rehydration first and stabilize the patient, then we worry about getting into the organism. The patient's not going to live long enough for a 10-day treatment. They're going to be dead in 2 days. They're going to be dead in an hour if we don't do something. So antibiotics are not first line of treatment. We have to get that hydration back up. So all of these agents then associated with contaminated water, we simply have a sanitation system, which we again take for granted. Not a problem. Without it, big problem. And we are not in any way specially genetically selected or whatever. If our sanitation was failed, we would come down with these diseases. Staph aureus, gram-positive cockle-shaped organism in clusters, staphylo. Means grape-like clusters of cockle-shaped organisms. That's what staphylo means. Strep, when we talk about strep, that's chains. This is staphylo organisms, grape-like clusters of cockle-shaped organisms. Staph aureus can cause other problems. We've already mentioned that you can have staph aureus causing pneumonia if a person was aspirating vomit and that kind of thing. And associated with that phases of unconsciousness, like drug abuse and so on. Now we're seeing staph aureus associated with a food poisoning. There are several exotoxins associated with this organism causing food poisonings. One is a little more stable than the other, both protein, but one has a coating with carbohydrates. And they will cause vomiting and diarrhea. This will be an abrupt onset. There'll be no question that you are not well. Remember, we had salmonella where you sort of felt a little bit like you had too many beers, you know, mouths in around, not quite right, loose sort of. This is not that. This is the effects of the exotoxin that you ingested. This is essentially intoxication. The toxin is most commonly produced in the food that you're eating, and then you ingest the toxin. You can also have some of the toxin growing in the gut, but it's possible. So it can be argued that this is pure intoxication or that it's essential intoxication, okay, depending upon the status. Again, since it's food contamination, there are many different kinds of foods that it can be associated with. Carbohydrate sources are always good because we have fat and the organism grows quite well with different carbohydrates. So we associate it with foods that have high carbohydrate content. But really, many different foods could be involved with it. A lot depends on how it gets contaminated. I'll give you a brief case study. This one happened, an airplane that was going from Tokyo to Heathrow. And you go at the Great Circle route across to Alaska, Canada, on the way to London, England. When they got to Fairbanks, Alaska, they changed pilots and crew. They just flown up from Seattle. Next crew was going to take it from Fairbanks to London. It's a long way to go across the ocean there to get to Fairbanks, so that's a long flight. So now what they're going to do is the crew just flew up, and their belly time is dinner time. So they're going to be eating dinner, whereas the belly time of the crowd in the plane, hundreds of people, 747, a big plane, multiple bathrooms, and going, eight bathrooms a day. The plane crew, the plane passengers who are just waking up in Alaska, and then they fly across Canada, they are served breakfast. The breakfast is scrambled eggs that morning. The fellow in Fairbanks, Alaska, who was making the scrambled eggs, had a cut in his hand with staph aureus in it. He inoculates the eggs. They put them in the warmers for the food in the plane, and the trays, warming places, which are also then incubated for the organism to grow. So over the next few hours, as patients wake up, they serve breakfast, they put the lights on the plane and all that sort of stuff, and they're serving breakfast to the top. By the time they get over about Toronto, the first few people have GI tract distress, and they go into the handful of bathrooms, and they are not coming out. They are vomiting and diarrhea. The abdominal cramps are so strong that you can probably imagine sitting on the toilet, coming out of both ends, and not spilling a drop. You can imagine they're bent over by that. Strong abdominal cramps, projectile vomiting, and diarrhea. So they're not leaving the bathroom. Meanwhile, 80-100 people are in the aisles and in their strapped into their seats having the same problem. Vomiting and diarrhea throughout the plane. Over Newfoundland, they decide that since the crew is okay, they will continue on to Heathrow. When they got to the plane, there were two groups of people that had to be hospitalized. What two groups do you think had to be hospitalized? The young and the old, okay? And they were suffering dehydration. Both groups are at risk of having complications of dehydration. So we always have to keep that in mind about the loss of fluid in those two extreme groups. Everybody else, I assume, got free tickets or free airline miles or something like that. The plane itself had to be not clean, stripped. They took all the furnishings out of the plane, threw it away, all the way down to the middle frame. Carpeting, walls, ceiling, chairs, everything was taking place. So that was sort of not a good place. You can imagine being in an airplane exactly, this is how it comes about. They were fine one instant, and then just like that, vomiting and diarrhea. Okay? So there's no question about, I think I feel sick. None at all. You are good sick. Okay? Rapid onset. So when you see that in a patient, when they have this abrupt onset of rather dramatic symptoms, this is the effect of the exotoxins, and this is most likely then Staph aureus. As opposed to the Salmonella, which gave us, I don't feel too well. We never had a chance to even say that when we were already throwing up and everybody knew we weren't well. So, Staphylococcus aureus, gram positive, rapid onset, vomiting, diarrhea. Streams of egg being the problem. This is just some information about Salmonella. Again, you don't need to know the various species. There's over 100 of them. Here you see common ones, Typhimurium, and Enteritis. We can see that this was associated with contaminated pasteurized milk. Interesting thing what happened. It was a milk co-op that was doing such a great business, they expanded. When they expanded, they had to read through plumbing and move the milk around the facility before it put it in the containers, the cartons. And in the process, they put in a little circle loop that they then introduced contaminated milk, raw milk, pasteurized milk, back into the pasteurized milk. So they contaminated the pasteurized milk. Okay. And you can see that we have a little spike right here in the mid-80s, where we went from a background of 9 or so thousand, 10, 12,000, up to 27,000 cases. This simply shows the cases of typhoid fever when we add filtration. Sanitation works. It's an easy thing to be aware of. Filtration worked a little bit, certainly, but when we add chlorine to the system, gram-negative organisms are particularly susceptible to chlorine. We give you a whole bunch of gram-negative organisms. Chlorination works quite well with gram-negative. Some more organisms. Clostridia botulana, you've heard of botulism. People look at the cans in the stores and they're all swelled up and they say, you get botulism. Chances are botulism is not going to produce that kind of gas, so it may be contaminated with some of the organisms, it may or may not even be a pathogenic organism. But swelled up cans is usually not true. Clostridia botulana has two forms, adult form and infantile form. Clostridia organisms are gram positive rods that are spore formers. Okay? Most of the organisms that produce spores, bacterial spores, are gram-positive rods. So here we have an organism that produces spores, and as soon as we see that, we say, well, spores are going to be part of the problem. And that's exactly right. So we have spores introduced into the food system that germinate, produce the vegetative state, which then produces the toxin. In the adult form, this is pure intoxication. We don't have any equivocation about it because what happens is the spores germinated in the food. The vegetative cells produce the spore, produce the toxin, botulism toxin, and then die. There are no organisms living in that food source anymore. The only thing left is the toxin. If we look for organisms, nothing would grow. On that assumption, you say, well, it's okay to eat. Not so fast. The toxin is still there. So the toxin is ingested by the adult and produces the problem of botulism. In the infant ingests the spores or the vegetative cell, which then the spores convert the vegetative cells in the gut, or the vegetative cells are there now, and they grow in the gut. So we have a bacterial infection. The organism produces the toxin in situ in the intestinal tract of the child. This is then, therefore, essential intoxication, because we have both the organism in the patient, and we have the toxin. Why is there a difference? Well, thing that you ate as the vegetative cell. The vegetative cell is susceptible to the acid conditions of your intestinal tract, or the GI tract, stomach, and so on. And as a result, you then destroy the bacterial cell. You wouldn't destroy the spore, but the spore would germinate, and the vegetative cell would be destroyed. So you kill it. The GI tract pH is sufficient to provide protection. So you cannot get essential intoxication. You cannot have the organism growing in your gut producing the toxin. What about the child? Well, if you've ever had a child, or if you've ever babysat a child, the newborn comes home, and you're all geared up, this is your first kiddo, and you're all geared up, you think that the child is a tomato plant. So you keep your apartment very warm, because everybody knows that children like it really warm. Not true, they like it like you like it. They also think that you have to wear sleep. If you do that, you'll train the baby to sleep only when there's no noise. Marking good, take the baby to the party, have a good time, relax a little bit, kid hears the noise, right to sleep, right to the party. Condition. Otherwise, the kid wakes up like that. As soon as they hear noise. So here we've got this child, and the child, you change the diaper. You know, this is going to be the big event, you're changing diaper now. But it's not so bad. It's a little kid there, and it's like mustard. A little mustard doesn't smell bad. It's not a bad thing at all. Along about 3, 4, 5 months, we have a real human dump in there. It does gag you. It is sliding down the socks after the afternoon nap. He is writing on the wall with it. This is disgusting stuff. Okay. What has happened? The intestinal tract has changed. When the child is born, it has an immature gut. And the immature gut has a neutral pH, which makes some sense if you think the baby is breastfeeding. It's going to take in food, and it's going to directly be absorbed in the bloodstream. There's no digestion going on there. In fact, as we'll see later, there are even antibodies, proteins, in mother's milk. And there are lymphocytes, cells, in mother's milk, and they too will find their way untouched into the bloodstream of the child. This is a good thing. So whatever goes in goes right in the bloodstream. There's no digestion going on. As the child's gut matures, we start actually digesting food. We have a pH change, because you know how it is that we control the enzyme activity by regulating pH and so on, so that way you don't digest yourself, right? You don't have the enzyme going all active all the time. And you change that when you eat. Otherwise, you would be digesting yourself, because you're not that much different than a hamburger when you think about it, right? So you're not digesting yourself. You've got mucus protection, and you control when the enzymes are active and all that kind of stuff. Well, that's all learned by this child. So we have this gut that's not really mature, and now we have the entrance of the organism. Well, it's a neutral pH. The organism will grow. Remember, in your gut, acid condition, organism didn't grow. So the pH of the gut is the distinguishing factor. The young child then has the organism grow in the gut, producing the toxins. One afternoon, they do not wake up. This toxin is a central nervous system toxin. It is not vomiting and diarrhea. It is central nervous system problem, which will then result in paralysis. We normally see weakness initially in such muscles as those that are associated with the eyelids, and so your eyes droop a little bit, and your lip can't hold itself up, so you start drooling. That's the early signs. Then as it progresses, you'll lose the ability to coordinate your eyes. So you have double vision, because you can't coordinate your eye movements. Great on earth, okay. Then you'll have difficulty in swallowing. Difficulty breathing, respiratory arrest, and then cardiac arrest. So this is not vomiting and diarrhea. Two case studies, one for each of these, so that you keep it fixed in your brain. The little old lady in the Italian section in Chicago, known for her sweet sauce. In chemistry, you know what pHs are, but you don't know what pHs are in terms of food, maybe. There's the chemistry of food, right? There's the chemistry of everything. And And so a sweet sauce is a more neutral sauce, not an acid sauce. But she has a neutral sauce. She uses those Italian Roma plum tomatoes, the ones that have less acid in them. She also doesn't can her tomato sauce, at least not effectively. She doesn't add acid to her tomato sauce. A little bit of lemon juice would do that. You ever made anything, put a little lemon juice in the canning? That's the lower pH. Why? Because the lower pH will kill the organism. But she doesn't have that. She doesn't cook, pressure cook her sauce. She doesn't add the acid. She uses tomatoes that are more neutral. So now she has good media for this organism. One Sunday morning, she's home. Everybody else went to church. They come back. She's dead on the kitchen floor. You call 911, and the emergency people come out, and she had a cardiac arrest. Happens. People die of heart attack. They bury her a few days later, and at the wake, everybody is eating her sauce. 23 people come down with difficulty in swallowing, double vision, yada yada, and they all go to the hospital. Because they weren't alone and they could see it in one another, they could see something was wrong, not right. And so they then exhumed the body of the little grandmother, and she was pickled with the toxin. She apparently was tasting the sauce as she was cooking. Okay. So we have the adult form of botulism. You ingest the fully made toxin. The toxin is stable under mild heating, so you really have to boil something for 10 minutes or more. And if you think about sauces and things, you don't boil the sauces. It sticks in the bottom of the pan. You heat it up, but you don't boil it. So in home canning, the use of lower pH is certainly a common way of doing it. And using citric acid or lemon juice will do it. In an industrial setting, what we do commercially is we autoclave everything. And when we autoclave things, we have it's all done by regulations and so on. But when you autoclave something, each of that something has a batch number on it. So that little code on the side of the jar is a batch number. And part of that information there tells us when it went through the autoclave. And there's a slip of paper, probably digitized now, but we have a record of the actual temperature conditions of that particular batch lot that went through the autoclave. So if we find a problem, someone has a problem someplace, we track the batch, we can see whether it was autoclaved sufficiently. If not, it didn't get the proper temperature and pressure conditions, then we would recall that whole group. And we avoid major problems in the food industry that way. Okay, so that lot number is important. It tells exactly, because we have a record for each lot, what the conditions were. 121 degrees centigrade, 15 to 20 minutes, 15 pounds per square inch pressure, the typical autoclaving condition. Okay, so that was the adult form. The infantile form, in California, we had a cluster of SID patients, sudden infant deaths. Unknown cause at the time. Sudden infant death, SID. It was a cluster, so that made the epidemiologists a little interested. Maybe we can get to the bottom of what's causing this problem, SID. And so they did a complete epidemiological analysis. And they found out that all these patients had one thing in common. All their children had eaten raw honey. Checked out the honey had the spores of the organism. It was raw honey, it had not been pasteurized. And as a result, the spores were not in any way harmed by the process. So basically, we have a source of spores, and they were then being fed to children about 3-4 months of age. We'd be mixing it into their cereals, and we start feeding them a little bit. They get hungry, they can't. Mother's milk or baby bottle is not sufficient to keep the kid content, and we start adding flavored white cereal and that. And you could spice it up with something, and the parents were spicing it up with honey. And of course, if they ate the honey or they ate the cereal, nothing bad happened to them. But feeding it to the child gets the organism to grow in the gut. As soon as it produces sufficient toxin, kill the child. So it was not the unexplained sudden infant death problem, but rather it was infantile population. As a result of that, you look in the jar of honey, you will see not to be given to children, it says, and actually, I think it goes up to age 10 or something like that. Lawyers make it so that, you know, beyond any doubt that it's going to cause a problem. Basically, you know, 3 months, 5 years of age, that's our biggest thing. So we're trying to give children under the age of 5 to eat raw honey. And honey's hard to pasteurize because it's so viscous. So even when it's pasteurized, just be on the safe side. The legal people come in and tell them to put the label on to protect the honey from manufacturers. But if you look in a jar, it will say, there's a note about children, about honey. And it's because of this. Okay. Now, if we have a patient like that, we can treat the patient, but we don't treat with antibiotics, generally. Maybe the infantile form, but really, if the infantile form is presenting itself as an intoxication, we have to deal with that toxin. We can neutralize the toxin with an antitoxin. As it turns out, there are maybe 10 or more different varieties of the toxin, each one requiring its own specific antibody or antitoxin. Some are unusual varieties, and we don't include them in the typical off-the-counter kind of antitoxins. But the antitoxin that we use is a polyantitoxin, that is, it involves many different multiple valences, multiple varieties of antibodies. It's not just pure anti-A variety, it's a mixture. So we have this antiserum that we can use. Now, anytime we use an antiserum for an intoxication, and there'll be other examples like tetanus and so on, anytime we use an antiserum for intoxication, initially it will have no effect. Initially, the patient will get a little worse. Because what we're trying to do inside the bloodstream of the patient is titrate the toxin-antitoxin interaction. Once the toxin is bound, in this case, to the central nervous system, the antitoxin has no effect on it. It's only the free toxin that can be complex with the antibody. So that means that while you're injecting the antitoxin, additional toxins binding to the nervous system, therefore the person will get a little bit worse. They will then ultimately stabilize, and once stabilized, then they will gradually get better. They will get gradually better because the antitoxin has no effect on the bound toxin, and eventually the bound toxin decays as a biological molecule. This could take many days to weeks, in which case we typically put the person on a respirator if their respiratory tract system is failing. And then we just sort of stabilize it. So the antitoxin, the sooner you get it into the patient, the sooner you can stabilize them. If you get them when they just have a weakness of an eyelid or something, or they're drooling a little bit, that's okay. We can stabilize that. But if you get to the point where they are in cardiac arrest, respiratory arrest, it's too late. But antibodies are the answer, not the antibiotics. And the infantile form, yeah, we'll probably use antibiotics, you know, but we're going to use it in conjunction with the most important part, which is the antibiotic. Next organism, Campylobacter, fetus. Gram-negative organism, Campylobacter. An unusual organism in some characteristics. It's called Campylobacter fetus. And sometimes we even talk about a subspecies. The subspecies is jejuni. Campylobacter fetus subspecies jejuni. What is jejuni? Where have you heard that at? Part of the intestinal tract, yes? Okay, so that's where the organism attaches by common villi. So it has a preference. It's called Campylobacter fetus because it's one of the unusual bacterial infections that can actually cross the placenta and invade the fetus. The placenta is pretty good at protecting. Not most, but only a few organisms can actually cross the placenta, and here's one that can. So a child could be born with this problem. Campylobacter fetus causes a chronic relapsing or recurrent bloody diarrhea. We will not use those expressions with any other organism. Chronic relapsing, recurrent, bloody diarrhea. You can have this infection for decades. Okay? And what happens is the organism causes an abscess in the intestinal tract. The abscesses, when they are intact, don't release the organism, so you have a period of no problem. And then after several weeks, maybe a month or so, you'll have a breaking of one of these abscesses, releasing organisms, resulting in a bowel, so to speak, a case of diarrhea. Because we have the breaking of an abscess, we have blood associated with that diarrhea. After about 7 to 10 days of the diarrhea, it goes away. Why 7 to 10 days? Secretory IgA, sure. So now it goes away and we don't have a problem anymore. Until we have another abscess break loose and we do this whole thing all over again. Again and again and again. The people at risk are the extremes of age. Young children, 3 months, 5 years of age, and the elderly. It's easily treatable, it's not difficult to treat. But in some groups of individuals, it's just thought to be something that, well, that's what old people get. It's nothing new. I mean, they live through it. Older people get it. Remember, the secretory antibody is the last one to come online at age 5 years of age or so on, and it's one that we lose as we get older. And so those are the age ranges that are in there. And in some cultures, usually rural cultures in America, it's just, well, that's what, you know, old people get. They get this problem. So if they think it's not a disease, they think it's just something that happens when you get old, they don't think enough to take it to the doctor to get treated. And so it goes on for decades. Grandma had this problem since she was 70. She's now 93. Why? Because they didn't think it was an infectious disease. They just thought it was something getting old. So easily treatable once it's brought to the attention of the physician. How do they get it? Well, it's associated with the intestinal tract of chickens and other farmyard animals. Chickens are particularly susceptible to get it. And if you think about the fecal material of a chicken, it's sort of like birds. It's sort of a runny, gooey stuff. But birds have that because they have a combined fecal-urinary system. And their opening is the cloaca. Okay, so they don't have one place they pee out of and one place they stuff box, right? It's one thing. So it's a cloaca, which is a combined fecal urinary system. And this basically gives us what appears to us as a chronic diarrhea, but it's really urine and fecal material together. That's why when birds fly over the carpet, they on top. The cows will fly, they just put dents in your carpet. So we have the organism now being scattered all over the barnyard. Little kid picks up something to play with, puts it in their mouth, they got it. But it's usually contamination. So there's usually a rural setting, and a setting in which people are involved with, you know, chickens and ducks and geese and stuff like that. There is one other possibility, because it's associated with eating raw chicken parts. Now you say, well, who eats raw chicken parts? How about liver pate? Chicken liver. Raw chicken liver, onions, minced up, all kinds of flavoring things to it, and so on, spices and such, put it on a cracker. Okay. One fellow I know who worked at Vanderbilt in Tennessee had his graduate students. Anybody want to make $5,000 in 2 months? They got a car, a Vanderbilt University car, and they got to go around the various farms. Okay, what farm they went to right now, and do rectal smears on chickens. Imagine that. Rectal smears on chickens, okay? Bringing the sample back, it was like 80-some percent of the chickens had Campylobacter. Very common, okay? The fecal material of chickens. Now, again, if it was a farm that didn't have any, there would be none, and the farm that hadn't stopped, there would be many. So it's a common kind of thing. Occasionally we get it in an industrial setting. We've had it in Traverse City, an industrial setting. What happens if you have a franchise for some hamburger place, McDonald's or whatever? If you have a franchise for it, part of the franchise agreement is you must buy all of your supplies from them. So not only does it, once across the street, you know, it costs maybe $1.2 million to buy, maybe $4 million to buy. They make probably $10 million a year across the street from the hamburger. And so those places, part of the franchising agreement is you have to buy all the stuff from McDonald's. You actually go to a school, McDonald's U. So they tell you that you have to buy all the stuff from them. Well, it's expensive. So this guy from Traverse City was cutting corners. And he was getting in some meat from surrounding farmers and selling it as McDonald's or whatever. I don't remember the McDonald's. Nonetheless, one of those units was contaminated, a local product, with Campylobacter. And then it came out in the hamburgers. And of course, it was a big investigation. Was the franchise contaminated? What? It turned out that the guy was sort of slipping some, buying some meat locally, and he lost his franchise and all that. So occasionally it gets into the food supply for everyone else. That's not common. A much more common situation is a rural setting in which they have chickens and birds and so on, and children, old people, and they all get it, and it's very common. And again, the other unusual thing about this organism is that if a pregnant woman has it, this organism will cross the placenta. That's an unusual situation. This is the only organism that's a GI tract organism that will cross the placenta. It's an unusual situation. Helicobacter pylori. This organism is a spiral-shaped gram-negative organism. Helico, as in helicopter. But it's really the Archimedes screw kind of thing. Helicobacter pylori, of course, pylori referring to the GI tract. This organism is associated with duodenal ulcers, GI tract ulcers. It was thought for a very long period of time that ulcers were associated not with a microbial agent, which could be treated, cured, but rather it was a weak constitution on the part of the person. They personally couldn't handle the stress of their life. And they were given bland diets, told to stop smoking, which is not a bad idea. Told to get out of their job and retire from the high-pressure jobs that they have. They can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. No thought of anything other than that. And of course, it was treated by using agents that would suppress acid production in the GI tract. And there are different varieties of H2 inhibitors, and you get all that in the other classes. So a variety of agents you can use. Glaxo used to make the product, and we think what it's called now, Tagamet. And they sold about $1 billion of Tagamet a year treating this problem. B with a billion, not billion with B. And after discovering that you could treat with antibiotics, a relatively short course of treatment with commonly used antibiotics that would cost very little, their sales went down to a few millions, and then suddenly became an over-the-counter drug. So you could take it for and acid. They weren't too happy about the discovery, I'm sure. The organism, the Helicobacter organism, is associated with milk products, cheeses that are contaminated that were not pasteurized. So commonly there's a connection back to contaminated food, usually unpasteurized cheese. Someone goes to Mexico, they eat the cheese there, or they sneak it back to the country and they send it to their friends with grape cheese or goat cheese or whatever it might be, sheep cheese, something you can't buy in Meijer, and it's not pasteurized, and that's how they're getting it. But once you get it, it will stay for a long period of time. Now, most of which we understand, that is, we now can treat it. We treat it with sulfa drugs and dimethyprim, and we treat it with bismuth-containing compounds like pepto-bismol, a little stronger than the over-the-counter pepto-bismol. And usually a relatively short course of treatment, maybe 2 to 4 weeks. then you're fine. As opposed to taking tag of it for the rest of your life. Not so fine. However, there are some little oddities about this organism which make it stand out. One, there, in order for it to cause this local ulcer, there has to be a fissure, a crack, an opening in the gut. Question, can the organism cause that, or did something else cause it? Is this organism an opportunistic organism that gets in the crack after somebody else got, something else created it? We don't know. So the initial fissure in which the organism finds itself, we don't know how that's created. The other question that's sort of curious is that when the organism is in that little fissure and it is causing this constant irritation and the ulcer, when it's doing that, it's also stimulating in a non-antigenic manner, stimulating cells in that area to divide. So it's producing some sort of mitogenic compound. It's stimulating cells in the area to divide. So it's not necessarily immune-based cells. It's not an antigenic stimulation of any sort. It seems to be just a mitogenic stimulation of the tissue in that area. And in some patients, this leads to esophageal cancer. So here we have an agent that can cause cancer, a bacterial organism that can cause cancer. And what more is interesting, we can treat it and prevent it with antibiotics. So we don't have to take tag and meds for 20 years. We don't have to have an increased risk of cancer. We can just treat it with commonly used antimicrobial agents, and it's gone. Yeah. So we can prevent cancer by treating this organism. Curious. Not the expected outcome. The Serial Monocytogenes. Gram-negative organism. The Serial is an unusual organism in terms of its temperature range in which it grows. We talked about growth conditions earlier and so on, and most organisms with Clostridium disease are growing at mesophiles or in the middle range of temperature. Here's an organism that's a cryophile. It grows when it's cold. It grows in the meat lockers. It grows in the freezers. The little icicles and stalactites and stalagmites are in the dripping from the air conditioning unit or the cooling unit. That's where we find this organism, growing in the ice. It likes it cold. It's called monocytogenes because it invades, gets inside of monocytes, macrophage. So that's another unusual thing. It's actually going inside our cells. It's an intracellular pathogen. Not a common thing. So it's got a part of the thing, monocytogenes, making it invade. It seems to be a relatively low virulence, and the patients that come down with serial infections are typically extremes of age, 3 months to 5 years of age in the elderly population, or potentially immunocompromised patients as well. In those settings, it can be fatal. It seems to have a connection with chickens, and we see it commonly with chicken products that have been frozen. But it's not limited to that. But that's a common thing. So as we saw an increase, for example, in the other white meat story, or that's pork, right? So the original white meat is chicken. And we saw an increase in the use of chicken in making chicken burgers and chicken hot dogs and chicken this and chicken. And so we started putting brown chicken together and so on, as opposed to cooking it whole. We started increasing the cereal. And just how that is it part of the GI tract of chickens that's not yet well figured out? Cereal monocytogenes. So if you look through these little episodes, these little stories, there's usually something about the organism that makes it stand out. And those are the things that you should be aware of. Thinking in terms of case studies and exams. And also keeping in track of what you're going to deal with patients that have GI tract problems. Well, what about this patient that makes it so that they have this organism? This was an outbreak of botulism, and you notice we have different kinds of things. We have jalapeno peppers in Michigan, a Mexican restaurant. We have potato salad, sauteed onions, fermented products, and baked potatoes. The baked potatoes were actually sold at a restaurant, it was a Tex-Mex restaurant, and they put sauce on them. It wasn't the potatoes itself, it was the sauce. All of these were homemade products. So jalapeno peppers, potato salad had ingredients from homemade sauteed onions, and they were homemade recipe country. Going down the line, most of these things are not commercial, but rather homemade. And of course, that's where we get the origin in the system. Well, we mentioned already a protozoa organism. Now we have some more. We have Cryptosporidium and Giardia, two non-bacterial protozoa organisms that cause GI tract problems. Now, Cryptosporidium, farming, is associated with the production of cysts. You can think of them as a spore, but maybe not exactly like a spore, but they're similar. That's why the Cryptosporidium gets its name. But a cyst is more correctly put. These little cysts are resistant to chlorine and UV light. So that means that if they get into the sanitation system, chlorine and UV light, which is very effective with the gram-negative organisms, is not effective at all with these. Infiltration is basically the way to get rid of the problem. Cryptosporidium is associated with cattle. And what we see increasingly, large commercial establishments replacing the family farm. And we have a high number of animals in one area of the same genus and species. So we have pig farms, but not just 100 pigs, 10,000 pigs. We have cattle places, not just a few, but a whole bunch. Now, one of the problems they have is what do they do with all this shit? What do they do with all the waste products of these animals? It's significant. Okay? And of course, if you're running a profitable business, this is a cost to get rid of this. Okay? So what do you do with it? Ship around in trucks, and we didn't do this. And what happens commonly is at least some of it, and if it's an unscrupulous person, maybe a lot of it, is somehow put into the local stream. It ends up into the local filtration system. But even if everybody is perfectly fine and above board, bad things happen sometimes. Floods happen. Heavy rains happen. And that's what happened in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Heavy rains with significant runoff from farms put a large amount of Cryptosporidium into the system. The filtration system was not sufficient. Now, filtration, if you think about it, you're keeping back something and you're allowing the liquid to flow through. That clogs. You can imagine it doesn't clog. Okay, so they have a problem with filtration. And therefore, that's what happened here. And we had cases. Screen for the age again, 3 months to 5 years of age, elderly population, AIDS patients, Hodgkin's disease patients, immunocompromised patients, kidney transplant patients, all coming down with Cryptosporidium. Significantly complicating the life of those individuals who are immunocompromised, killing many of them. So we know it's a problem out there, but few communities have addressed this issue. Milwaukee was forced to do something. What they did, we don't know whether it's going to be ultimately good because we haven't had that same calamity of the water being contaminated with heavy amounts. Hopefully we solve the problem in Milwaukee, but we don't know yet. In other areas, of course, it's not been a problem for them, so they haven't addressed it. So Cryptosporidium is something that can easily be a problem in a community. Again, it's going to be a problem even in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We have pig farms and all that kind of stuff. You may not think of Grand Rapids as pig farming. You may not think of Grand Rapids as having a large number of cattle and so on, but they have an agricultural belt just like any other city. And that as the cities expand into suburbs, and suburbs grow, they encroach upon farmland. And if they do that, there's the interaction between these two subcultures, and part of the problem with the interaction is the way that it builds up. Yardia, Alice. This organism again produces a cyst type like structure that's resistant to chlorine and UV light. Filtration is usually not the solution. Boiling is the solution. So occasionally, if this gets into water, we have to boil the water. A particular note is that this organism is found in the intestinal tract of what we would refer to as wild animals, like deer and raccoon and so on. And so this is often a problem associated with backpackers. So you're out in the woods walking around, and you're packing your back and so on, and you're drinking mountain stream clear water. What you didn't know was the bear just used that as a toilet a half a mile off the stream. Now you're drinking what the bear deposited. So that's a common thing. Giardia lambia, different species, can also get with the intestinal tract of the animal, and that can cause vaginal infections and urinary tract infections should you be taking a bath or bathing or swimming in contaminated water. So Giardia organisms can cause problems, and again, the resistance to chlorine and UV light, so you've got your little chlorine tablets, and you put it in the drinking water and drink a lot, it's fine. Chlorine is sometimes we use iodine, which is another halogen, same sort of thing. It doesn't affect these products. What you have to do is have a little filter. So they have little travel backpack kind of filtering systems. That's what you need to do. You need to filter it, and you also need to add the chlorine and the iodine and so on to the water to get rid of the bugs. Okay. In this case, getting rid of protozoa organisms. We have a couple of protozoa in this mixture of agents. And again, these are not easily got rid of on your own. Both of these can cause GI tract problems, including diarrhea. They both cause a diarrheal problem in the patient. They tend to be chronic. You can't get rid of them easily. So you might have this for weeks or months. And sometimes they're difficult to treat. Again, patients who are at greatest risk for these are often immunocompromised patients, particularly for this beryllium. Viral agents. Rotavirus, epidemic acute gastroenteritis virus, also known as the Norwalk agent and as metadata agent. These are common agents of GI tract problems that result in vomiting or vomiting and diarrhea. So let's take a look at these. Rotavirus can cause vomiting and diarrhea. There are three serotypes of this organism. Obviously, it has receptor site matching to the lining of the gut. Now, interesting enough, that we know about secretory antibody, and that's going to be helpful. So if you're exposed to it, you'll get sick for about 7 days or so, and you start getting better. But because there's only three serotypes of the organism, we can inject you with these serotypes, and we have a vaccine for rotavirus. And the odd thing about it is that you'll have high levels of circulating immunoglobulin G, or IgG. These high levels can cross the gut. It doesn't work with all GI tract problems, but it does work with this one. This process of high levels of circulating antibody in the bloodstream, IgG, that crosses into the intestinal tract, it's got a funny name, it's called transsudation. T-R-A-N-S-U-D. Transsudation. Transsudation is this process of high levels of antibody crossing into the gut. Secretory antibodies, so we have IgG protecting the gut. So we have three serotypes of rotavirus, and we can then immunize people against it. This worked quite well. We immunized hundreds of thousands of children, and then we had a problem. The problem was an unusual problem, called interstitiation, which basically means a telescoping in of the intestinal tract. Now, we are immunizing children in the first year of life, and some of these children, after immunization, develop this telescoping in, which would create an intestinal block, potentially a fatal problem. In both of these, in these handful of situations, the pediatrician did an endoscope and took a look at it, and as soon as they got the instrument in that area of the intestinal tract, it straightened right out. And they said, oh, that's good, let's get out of here. And they backed out, and the problem's gone. There was no treatment, per se, it was this. Now, since the person, had, the child, had just been immunized against rotavirus, and this happened, the logical phenomena of post hoc ergo proctor hoc entered in. It follows, therefore, its cause problem. Obviously, rotavirus caused this problem, or so it's thought. So we took it off the market, because rotavirus does not generally kill people in the United States. And we just give them Pedialyte and so on, and they'll survive. So it's not a lethal threat to our children. And so we have a potential lethal problem associated with the vaccine, so we took it off the market. Ultimately, after several years of testing, we find that there was no connection at all. Statistical fluke, just a handful of people out of the many, many, many that were immunized, and no causal relationship at all. In fact, if this situation occurs with people who weren't immunized, it's just something that happens, possibly a developmental situation, as the guy was developing. Remember, we said the guy was immature, and maybe just developmental phenomenon, but not related to immunization. But nonetheless, they pulled off the market, and it took us about 10 years, or 8 to 10 years, and we now have 2 on the market now, and a 3rd one coming on shortly. 3 different companies have produced this profitable situation because they make a vaccine for all the children in the United States. The problem was, worldwide, this had a completely different effect. There's an area around Ecuador, Africa, about 100 kilometers either side of the equator, north and south, what we call the diarrheal belt. And in this area, we have tens of thousands of children die every year of a combination of diarrheal diseases. Of course, it could be better if we had sanitation, and it would be good better, even more, if we had lots of Pedialyte around and so on, but that's not the case. These children are dying from diarrheal diseases. And immunization, which is not available for most of those other ones, would be good. Thousands of children would survive because we had this immunization. However, and I talked to a couple of the ministers of health of these countries, and some of the media that they do, their attitude was this: if it's not good enough for the United States, we're not going to be your guinea pigs. We don't trust them. So the minister of health take it off the market in Africa, where it really could do some good. Even if 5 out of the 5 million or whatever had a problem, that's still a lot of people that are saved, even if this was a natural case. As it turned out, it wasn't even a problem. This collapsing of the intestinal tract is not associated with the vaccine. But during the time, 8 years or so, in which these were off the market, tens of thousands of children died every year because of that decision. It's an interesting kind of phenomenon. Our interaction, if you think about, all our politics and all of that, and mixed into the whole world and all that kind of stuff, actually kills people in other countries. They lose faith in what we are doing. It's a strange kind of effect of politics and medicine and so on. So rotavirus. We also have an epidemic acute gastroenteritis virus. It goes by many different names. Norwalk agent is one of them. This is the one that causes the problem in cruise ships. Okay. So we have this collection of people, somebody's got it, it's highly infectious among susceptible population. Again, causes nausea, sometimes vomiting, but clearly diarrhea. And definitely can ruin your cruise. Okay. So you see, cruise boats are not small things. Okay. Thousands of people on the boat. Hundreds of them become sick, ruin their vacation, and thousands of others would have to be concerned about them getting it, or maybe seeing somebody throwing up and vomiting. If the edge of the sitting at the captain's table, the captain says, bleh. So the virus here, there are many, many different serotypes. A vaccine then is not likely. It's a matter of hygiene. The virus is fairly stable, so it's not just mild hygiene, but we have to be very good at it. And of course, any place that we have, you know, a long cafeteria-style thing where we have people, various people digging in and picking around the food before you get to dig in and pick around the food. There's a sneeze bar that they should look under and go around and everything else. They touch something and then leave it behind and whatever. Okay. And so that kind of serving system is more likely to spread among the higher population than if you have someone come to your table and put a plate on your dish, or a plate in front of you with the food. Okay. So served food is a little less risky. If you've got a choice of the two during those epidemics, you know where to go. These are not typically the people on the ship, because they're very concerned about this. It's ruined business. Okay. So they're very concerned about it. So they are very good behind the scenes. It's all your other fellow passengers, particularly when you're in this cafeteria style. That's pretty good. You're likely to get a contamination. Now, if there was an epidemic going on, we could have either of these happening. And let's say that we have only the younger brother in kindergarten has got this diarrhea. Nobody else in the family got it. All the kids in day school, preschool and daycare, that age is getting it. But the older brothers who are third grade, fourth grade, sixth grade, parents, uncle and aunts, nobody else gets it. Right. Then we have another epidemic in which kids in school get it, they bring it home, the parents get it. It's Christmas time or something, you're visiting relatives, they got it, everybody, aunts and uncles, everybody thinks you got it. First epidemic was, which one of these two? Rotavirus. There's only three serotypes. Everybody else has already experienced all three. So they're protected. Okay. In the epidemic of acute gastroenteritis virus kind of thing, the Norwalk agent and so on, that's what we see it spreading amongst all age groups because nobody's seen it before. Many different serotypes. So by the epidemiology, you have an idea of what's going on, which one it is. The last agent associated with the GI tract that we have listed here for viruses is hepatitis A. So we're going to go into more detail when we talk more about STDs, not because hepatitis A is necessarily an STD, although we'll talk about some World Health Organization observations. We're going to consider hepatitis A as a GI tract problem. But we want you to compare all the different hepatitis viruses, and we'll do a better job of that when we go into more detail with the other hepatitis B and C and D. But hepatitis A, to a lesser extent, hepatitis E, are associated with contaminated food, particularly contaminated water. So a little bit about hepatitis. Hepatitis is nothing more than an inflammation of the liver. It can be caused by a variety of different things. There's a chemical hepatitis. So someone could have a reaction to be exposed to a chemical. That chemical might be a drug. That chemical might be an anesthetic agent. Someone who is an anesthesiologist and they're working with various gases. Some of the gases are leaking and the patients don't get too disturbed about it. But the people who work in that OR every day are getting a heavier exposure and they're coming down with hepatitis. So it's a chemical hepatitis, not microbial origin. Then we have viral hepatitis. And there are many viruses that can cause a viral hepatitis. For example, Epstein-Barr virus. Okay. That's the agent that causes infectious mononucleosis, or IM. So Epstein-Barr virus causes a hepatitis. So a person has Epstein-Barr virus that is spread by droplets from person to person. It then gets in your body and stimulates your B cell lymphocytes to divide. So it's a B cell mitogen. And when it stimulates your B cells to divide, you'll produce a wide variety of initial antibodies, and these are called heterophile antibodies. And that's how we diagnose mononucleosis, the presence of antibodies to guinea pig tissue and horse tissue and things like that. We don't even look for an antibody to Epstein Barr. But in some patients, they'll get this lymph nodes involved, the spleen is all enlarged, they'll get a nasty sore throat at some point, not really a secondary bacterial infection, it's part of the viral infection. And then a few of them will get hepatitis. So that's usually a rather dramatic form of Epstein-Barr causing mononucleosis. For many people, it's maybe a six-week kind of phenomenon. But if you go into the full-blown thing where you get the hepatitis, it's probably been 6 months or longer that you have it. So it's Epstein-Barr virus is sort of interesting. It causes what we might call a self-limiting lymphoproliferative disease. Self-limiting because eventually you get it back under control. Lymphoproliferative meaning it's stimulating lymphocytes to your body. It's like a leukemia. It's like an infectious leukemia. So that's Epstein-Barr virus. It can cause hepatitis. So a person who has mononucleosis and they develop hepatitis, that doesn't mean they got hepatitis A or B or D or whatever. It's probably Epstein-Barr virus. Then we have the family of hepatitis viruses, A, B, C, D, E, and there are others as well, but just A, B, C, D, E. A and E are associated with contaminated water. So those are the ones that are properly associated with the GI tract problem, A and E. Hepatitis B, C, and D are not spread by food and water. But if you look at the asterisks, hepatitis B, C, and D, and Epstein-Barr are not spread by food and water, but they cause that. So this hepatitis, what we're seeing here in terms of symptoms, in a general sense, you're going to have abdominal pain, you're going to have nausea, vomiting. If you're a Caucasian, your skin may turn a little yellowish. Regardless of your skin tone, your whites of your eyes may turn yellowish. We call this jaundice, of course. We'll go into more detail between A, B, C, D, E a little later. Just recognize that it's possible. So if we think about it, the next time you see someone who is walking through a flood, and you'll see it on television all the time, it's flood, and there's people out there walking, pushing their belongings in a raft or some sort of canoe. Their kids are playing in the water. What are they playing in? They're playing in contaminated water. What's in there? Bacteria, fungal organisms, cryptococcal organisms, eukaryotic organisms, viral organisms, it's all in there. Okay. They're all exposed to hepatitis A, etc. We'll talk most more about hepatitis A and others in the later. So when we get to